Good morning. My name is Chris Forsyth, registration 22608. I'm here representing Michelle Eller, the appellant in this matter. The purpose of the Workers' Compensation Act is to resolve disputes without the necessity of litigation. That's the overriding purpose of the act. Here we have a case where the claimant treated with a physician selected by the employer, that is the authorized treating physician, treated for some time. The physician placed her at maximum medical improvement and provided an impairment rating. Those facts brought in the statute 842.107.2, the selection of a division IME, into play. Because the employer did not object, did not file a notice and proposal, the statute specifically provides that they are bound by the findings and determinations of the treating physician. It's a jurisdictional issue. Case law has been issued before on the fact that it's a jurisdictional issue regarding claimants, regarding employers in different factual scenarios. This factual scenario is different from previous case law because the employer claims it is not bound by that statute because it had not admitted liability.
Well, Mr. Forsyth, you talk about the purpose of the law. Isn't the entire act premised on the assumption that the worker has incurred a compensable injury under 841.301?
That an injury has occurred in the course and scope of employment, I would believe is a correct statement.
So does that issue ever leave? Is a treating physician in a position to make that decision?
This is not that case. If the issue in this case had been, did the injury incur in the course and scope of employment, I believe what you're thinking would be right. A judge needs to determine that issue. That wasn't the issue in this case, as is shown by the judge's order. The judge went through and reconciled the medical evidence, finding their independent medical evaluator more persuasive than the treating physician in resolving a medical causation issue. There was no course and scope argument on this case. So this case is factually different, I believe, from the case that Judge Graham is presenting regarding when a hearing should be held. In this case, because the judge specifically went down and went through the medical records and found the independent medical evaluator that they selected more persuasive than the treating physician, it is obviously a mixed issue that is not simply a course and scope issue. Therefore, the division IME statute came into play. Because it is the respondent that requested oral argument in this case, I'm going to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Paul Kruger, attorney number 34592. I represent CCMSI and Boulder Valley School District. With me at council table is Kate Allison, Assistant Attorney General. She is present. I'll be presenting the argument. If you have any questions to direct towards the Attorney General's office, she is willing to address those issues. The Workers' Compensation Act, since 1919, has been amended, varied, things have been added numerous times. One thing that has always remained the same: you're not entitled to workers' compensation benefits unless you've sustained an injury arising out of the course of your employment. That has always been within the jurisdiction of originally the Industrial Commissioner, now the Administrative Law Judge. Nothing has ever changed from that standard, and it's a legal standard. It is not a medical standard. Admittedly, in compensability cases, medical evidence is presented all the time. Of course it is. But at the end of the day, the Administrative Law Judge is charged with deciding whether or not there is an injury which arose out of the course of the employment. In this particular case, the respondents from the very beginning filed a notice of contest. They questioned this case, as is their right. They went ahead and provided medical treatment for the claimant pending a hearing on compensability. It's a strange situation. It's one of those that doesn't happen as much when a claimant reaches maximum medical improvement and gets an impairment rating prior to injury. What the respondents did to protect their right later, if the matter was found to be compensable, was to stay their requirements with regards to requesting a division-sponsored independent medical examination, and that there was an order granting that request by a pre-hearing administrative law judge, who, of course, have the discretion to do that, as a DIME is a evidentiary matter, and pre-hearing administrative law judges have the authority and the jurisdiction to rule on discovery, evidence, things of that sort. So the issue before the administrative law judge was not causation, it was not maximum medical improvement, it was not impairment. The sole issue before the administrative law judge was whether the claimant sustained a compensable injury. And this case is almost a perfect example of why claimant's argument fails. First and foremost, they didn't really contest in this case that the claimant fell. Of course she fell, and she fell at work. The issue was whether or not that accident arose out of the employment, whether or not that accident was due to job duties, whether or not it arose out of her of something she was doing for her employer. The ALJ found that it didn't. Consequently, that's not a medical determination. That's a factual determination based upon the credibility of the evidence presented, based upon the credibility of the claimant. That's, again, not a medical determination. The authorized treating physician was in a position to, here's what I think is wrong with her. He was not in a position to determine it happened at work and it's compensable. That's a legal determination. We could sit and chat and discuss the dozens of different compensability theories that an authorized treating physician would have no knowledge of.
I'm sorry, Constable, to interrupt, but did the ALJ find that the claimant did in fact fall on the floor or out of the chair?
Yes, but the fact here was that the claimant, what the ALJ found based upon the determination, was that the mechanism of injury was that she was talking on the phone to her daughter and fell over backwards in the chair. He determined that that activity did not arise out of the employment. And importantly, on appeal, the ALJ's factual determinations are not being contested. Whether or not that was properly arising out of or not is not being challenged on appeal. The only thing that's being challenged on appeal is whether or not the respondents are bound by the authorized treating physician's opinion. And importantly, as Judge Graham pointed out, the standard in 843.301 is the same. The standard in 842.201 provides administrative law judges with the jurisdiction to hear any controversy arising out of the act. And the Division Independent Medical Examination Statute specifically states it's regarding maximum medical improvement and impairment. There's nothing in the division statute, the Division Independent Medical Examination Statute, addressing compensability. And it's clear why. And it even says so in the statute. It's to resolve disputes regarding maximum medical improvement and impairment, not compensability in the first instance. The act is long, it's very detailed, and it contains the information when there's a compensable claim, not something that's here. The DIME claimant argues on appeal, and I'll touch briefly on these two issues. First, argues that it denies equal protection, that because respondents would have had the opportunity to request a DIME before the hearing, that denies claimants equal protection. Again, that argument fails because there's a legitimate governmental purpose to the DIME statute in this regard. If respondents wanted to go ahead and admit, they could have. And that would have resolved the dispute if claimant would have been satisfied with that admission. Or respondents could have decided, well, this is an admissible claim, but we don't like the impairment rating, so we're going to request a DIME. If claimant would have been, then the DIME physician's opinion would have been binding on the parties. That reduces litigation with regards to maximum medical improvement and impairment. With regards to compensability, however, neither respondent did not request the DIME. Claimant was not prejudiced thereby, and the parties proceeded to hearing based on the underlying facts of the case for the administrative law judge to resolve. Claimant also argues that the statute 842.107.2 is vague and violates due process in so much as it's unclear whether or not it applies to compensability. That certainly is not the case. The statute specifically states that it applies to maximum medical improvement and impairment. It would be an incredibly strained reading of that statute to suggest that it addresses compensability in the first instance. Finally, the claimant alleges some evidentiary issues with regards to testimony. I'll let the brief pretty much address those. I just would like to point out, however, that an administrative law judge, just like a trial court judge, has great discretion with regards to evidence to be admitted, evidence not to be admitted. And consequently, the standard of review for that is whether the administrative law judge abused his discretion with regards to those evidentiary rulings. And one first last point with regards to the admission of the police records to demonstrate claimant's inconsistent statements, the administrative law judge in the written order never referenced the police records. The ALJ's determination denying compensability was based on claimant's credibility and her inconsistent statements with regards to the medical records and her presentation at hearing. Consequently, to the extent there's any error with that regard, it's entirely harmless and should be disregarded. Unless there are any further questions, Boulder Valley School District and CCMSI request that the ALJ's order denying compensability and the ICAO's order affirming the same be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Krueger.
Thank you.
Mr. Forsyth.
Nowhere in the judge's order does it say that the claim was not found compensable because it was not in the course and scope of employment because of a phone call. Counsel just said that that was the case in the order. It does not say that in the order. The order reconciles the medical evidence with the facts of the case, and the ALJ repeatedly gives deference to their independent medical evaluator over the authorized treating physician. That's what's not allowed. Because she had been placed at maximum medical improvement and impairment, wouldn't they challenge that if they challenge compensability? In other words, they're waiving their objection if they don't file a notice and proposal at that point. Obviously, they challenge maximum medical improvement and impairment because they're saying it's not work-related. Indeed, had the treating physician issued a report and said it was not work-related, they would have stood by that in a heartbeat. But the problem is the treating physician did say maximum medical improvement and impairment. Because he did so, it's obvious that it's a compensable claim. Therefore, to maintain their objection there, they had to request a division IME. That's why 842.107.2 comes into play. Instead, they got a judge to issue an order outside his jurisdiction, staying the proceedings, essentially, of the division IME, not giving Ms. Eller the opportunity to obtain a division IME, and proceeding to hearing, essentially giving the employer a second bite off the apple. They got to pick the doctor in the first place. The doctor didn't say what they wanted the doctor to say, so they went out and bought another doctor, got that doctor to say what they wanted him to say, and went to hearing. That's not the fairness that the Workers' Compensation Act envisions. The division IME process is key to the Workers' Compensation Act. And it specifically states within 30 days of the findings and determinations of the treating physician, which here were maximum medical improvement and impairment, they have to file a notice and proposal, or the findings of the treating physician are binding on the parties and on the division. So the treating physician's findings in that report are binding according to that statute. They want you to read a non-existent provision into the statute by saying, except where we have not admitted liability. The Workers' Compensation Act does not say that. If they didn't want that statute to come into play, they shouldn't have selected an authorized treating physician. Once they selected an authorized treating physician, then all the act came into play. And the 842.107.2 specifically says, when the authorized treating physician makes a finding and determination regarding MMI and permanent impairment, those findings are binding unless there's an objection and a notice and proposal within 30 days. Another comment that opposing counsel made in his statement was that this is a strange situation. That's an important note. it is somewhat of a strange situation. This is not an overarching proposition that we're arguing here today, which I believe they argued in their briefs. That's how I took their briefs, is that this is a huge deal in workers' compensation. This is a very factually specific case where she treated with the authorized treating physician, she was found to be at maximum medical improvement, and found to have permanent impairment related to the injury. It's also important to note that they got to depose the treating physician and present all these facts that we went to hearing on to the treating physician. Everything that went to the ALJ got presented to the physician. And the physician did alter his opinion a little bit and provide a little apportionment, but still left the impairment rating essentially the same. So the proposition that they're arguing for is just giving them bite after bite off the apple and leaving the claimant out in nowhere land to do anything about it. That is not due process. That's not due process allowed under the Act. They mentioned the equal protection and vagueness arguments. This violates equal protection because we're not being treated similarly under the Act. Under the Division IME statute, if a claimant fails to object within 30 days after they file a final admission of liability, there's nothing more. Case law is clear. You have to get that objection in within 30 days. That's the way the statute applies. Why aren't we applying it to them in the same way? It must be applied to them in the same way. It's a jurisdictional bar. Vagueness, if we have to guess the meaning of the statute, if we have to think, well, this doesn't apply when compensability is not admitted by the respondents, then we're reading something into the statute that's not there. That means it's vague. Now, I don't want to strike down the Division IME statute. I think it's a good statute. But I think the plain and clear meaning of the statute is in the words in the statute. And they, the ICAO, the ALJ, have all put excess verbiage into that statute. The statute says if the authorized treating physicians, and we agree, it means when maximum medical improvement and permanent impairment are addressed by the treating physician, those findings become binding unless there's a notice and proposal within 30 days. It's that simple. It's a very simple proposition. Nowhere does it say that they can continue to fight compensability. Now, arguably, which is not this case, if course and scope had been the issue, in other words, saying it didn't happen at work, arguably that's an issue for the ALJ. Here, we have a medical opinion, and the judge specifically relying on medical opinions in his order regarding causation. It's an important medical issue that medical testimony was crucial to. That's why they got a second doctor rather than going to hearing without a doctor. A doctor was necessary for this hearing regarding causation. Therefore, the Division IME statute came into play. They mentioned the evidentiary issues. The police reports were not admissible. And the judge did rely on them because they were at hearing. He admitted them, and he should not have. I think it's almost an admission from the respondents that the reports were improperly admitted. And lastly, I do have to address one thing that I have not addressed previously, and I apologize for that. They claim in their briefs that there was no objection regarding the Dale Hobbs testimony and this chair incident. On page 147 of the hearing transcript, however, at lines 15 through 19, there's a statement regarding that the objection was maintained regarding this testimony and the chair. It was maintained. These proceedings were recorded. I don't believe that the hearing transcript is complete. It appears that the prior objection was left off the record, but there was a timely objection made to the chair testimony. So to sum up, I believe the most important issue here today is whether 842.107.2 applies when compensability is challenged. The Industrial Claim Appeals Office has held that it does. Those cases were cited in the briefs. They said even when compensability is not admitted, this procedure applies. So they've already said that the procedure applies when compensability has not been admitted. So why isn't it applying here? It should. There's no reason, based on the fact of the statute, to not apply that procedure here. The ICAO has differed from its own previous cases saying that this statute applies in cases where compensability has not been admitted. What the ICAO apparently is saying is that they would not be able to proceed to a division IME in those other cases. Well, in this case, because causation, maximum medical improvement, and compensability were all essentially the same issue, they can't challenge the findings of the treating physician because they did not request a division IME within 30 days of the treating physician's report. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Forsyth. Thanks again to you, Mr. Krueger. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That completes our